Hello. We are back from our summer break. And so welcome to our new edition of Ukraine Calling for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. We are bringing you the latest news dealing with Ukraine, an in-depth interview, and some music. I am Bohdan Nahailo, and will be hosting the show. Our guest this week is Maxim Yakovlev, the new director of the School for Policy Analysis at the National University of Kyiv Mohyla Academy, a representative of the new generation of Ukrainian political scientists. Where is Ukraine at today, and where is it heading? That's our topic for tonight, or for today, for this week. First, a roundup of the news. Russian puppet killed in Donetsk. On the 31st of August, the leader of Russia's proxy forces in the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic, the so-called DNR, was killed by a bomb in a cafe in Donetsk, in the occupied area of eastern Ukraine. Moscow officials pointed the finger at Kyiv, but Ukrainian representatives and foreign observers were generally united in the belief that Zakharchenko was killed as a result of a conflict with his Russian sponsors. Ukrainian Orthodox Church for Ukraine? Expectations are high that top clerics in the Universal Orthodox Church are now ready to grant autocephaly to the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, that is, recognize its independence from the Moscow Patriarchate. In a tweet on Twitter, Ukraine's president, Petro Poroshenko, wrote that the Patriarch of Constantinople, Bartholomew, the Orthodox effective primate, and other church leaders had in effect recognized the right of Ukraine to have its own autocephalous Orthodox Church free from Moscow's imposed control. On the 31st of August, the Moscow Patriarch, Kirill, met Patriarch Bartholomew in Istanbul, but apparently failed to persuade him to recognize the Moscow Patriarchate's claim to have jurisdiction over Ukraine's Orthodox believers. Lawsuit against Russia. Ukrainian Justice Minister Pavlo Petrenko has announced that Ukraine has filed a lawsuit against Russia for illegally detaining Ukrainian political prisoners as a result of politically motivated persecution. The best known of them, Ukrainian filmmaker Oleg Sentsov, has been on a protest hunger strike for over 110 days now, and his case has generated considerable support internationally. Meanwhile, 22 Russian citizens serving sentences in Ukraine have recently asked President Vladimir Putin to be exchanged for Sentsov and other Ukrainian political prisoners being held in Russia. Now on to economic issues. Well, Ukraine's economy grew by 3.6% in the second quarter, beating forecasts as the recovery gathers steam, the State Statistics Service reports. But this week, Ukraine's central bank raised its key policy rate by half a percentage point and said inflation could only be kept in check if the government secured more International Monetary Fund aid. An IMF mission is currently visiting Kyiv to discuss financial assistance to support macroeconomic stability and sustainable and inclusive growth. The key issue is the release of a delayed further tranche of assistance valued at close to $2 billion. Meanwhile, at the request of the Ukrainian authorities, the World Bank is preparing a policy-based guarantee, PBG, to support key policy and institutional reforms to promote economic growth, fiscal sustainability, and improved governance. If approved, the proposed operation would provide a $650 million IBRD guarantee that is expected to help Ukraine raise about $800 million through a private transaction in the lending market. And a new political season opens. Well, the beginning of September has seen the resumption of intense political life after the summer break, with all the expected public posturing, horse trading, and recriminations. Parliament has reconvened against the background of, in effect, the launch of the presidential election campaign. The elections are due next March, which will be followed by parliamentary elections expected in October 2019. Meanwhile, civil society activists have been rallying outside the parliament, calling for changes in the electoral system that would open it up and provide for greater transparency and accountability. My guest this week is Maxim Yakovlev, a young political scientist, political methodologist, recently appointed director of the School for Policy Analysis at the National University of Kyiv Mohyla Academy, a very prestigious institution in this country. He's also an associate professor in the Department of Politics there. So welcome, Maxim.
Well, thank you for inviting.
Look, Maxim, you know, we find ourselves in these strange and turbulent times. Let's try and use the historical GPS. It's September 2018, 100 years of Ukrainian independence, or rather since the first attempt to establish a modern Ukrainian state was made, 27 years after the restoration of Ukrainian independence in another form after the Soviet period. We've just had this week the beginning of the latest parliamentary session, but most importantly, we're entering the sort of campaign phase, pre-presidential elections due in March of next year, and the parliamentary ones due in October of next year. Mm-hmm. So as a young political scientist, do you have a sense of a historical moment? Have we again reached a turning point, or is it a case of more of the same in these recent years?
Well, you know, to answer your question, it is always a problem to recognize that you are really experiencing and living up to a certain historical moment, because I think sometimes people realize that they actually lived and were and witnessed some historical developments only after they realize it and sit down and meditate and think for a while. That's why it's really difficult to tell that this is something of a particular importance for an average Ukrainian citizen, especially in Ukraine where politics is never boring. We had so many Maidans, different uprisings of people, actually.
And revolutions in our history. Yeah,
definitely, but a lot of revolutions. So what Ukrainians are really apt at are fighting for their rights and claiming their rights and establishing, well, actually overthrowing regimes, not only Ukrainian, but on the whole Soviet scale. A recent interview...
Polish, with, Russian, Austro-Hungarian.
Yeah, of course. Recently there was a talk show on Ukrainian 112, the TV channel, and there was an interesting Ukrainian politician whom we would refer to as the previous group of Party of Region people, Dobkin, the other person from Kharkiv. And when answering the question about what Ukraine really missed and what was the Ukrainian mistake, he said his first answer and was really surprised. He said the first mistake of Ukrainians was active cooperation and a very active contribution to the dissolution of the Soviet Union. So he really perceived that to be a problem. And he is a Ukrainian political person, well known with his own position. But we definitely understand that he shares this view of Mr. Putin, that the dissolution of the Soviet Union, as he said, was a catastrophe.
The greatest tragedy of modern times.
Exactly. So I would say that the majority of Ukrainians disagree with this statement. But answering your question, coming back to your question, I don't think that many Ukrainians realize that this is a truly historical moment, but they experience it from another perspective, from an economical one, because this year, especially this autumn, Ukrainian hryvnia, the national currency, since its exchange rate is something that is bothering many Ukrainians, and many Ukrainians worried about the economic prosperity and the future for Ukraine. And I do understand as a political science that we cannot substitute economic questions with the political questions, but on the level of political theory, we know if we really dwell on any economic theory and we really think deeply as well as about any political theory, they are very, very interrelated. So that's why I think this question is of high importance. The problem was 100 years of Ukraine re-establishing Ukraine independence. And this is unlike the Baltic states, who could really refer the history to back then, when Stalin and the Soviet Union called these countries limitrofe. So the problem with Ukraine independence, especially with Tabachnik, Minister of Education, and the Party of Region rule, is that many Ukrainians could really not relate to that what happened. And up to that, another historical moment is a very big interview of Medvedchuk, to, again, Studvinatsi, 112, the TV channel, where, you know, this movie about Stus and him being like, I don't know which is the correct English word for attorney lawyer or somebody who really
had to, defense counsel, yeah, I suppose in American, yes, yeah.
Something like that. And when he says that this is, he really said that, for example, he said that those people who evaluated the poems of Stus as being those anti-Soviet, these people are still active, working for Ukrainian legal enforcement agencies, now writing reports and other writing stuff. So this is, again, interesting development. That's why I think many Ukrainians, unfortunately, do not feel this heritage, because we had ups and downs in discussing the legacy of the Ukrainian People's Republic. I'm really glad I was a Ukrainian translator for May's book on Dilemmas of National Liberation. Of how the...
I know it well. He was a good friend of mine. This is about the 1920s, early 30s. I was with him when he was writing his doctoral dissertation in Harvard about that.
This is his doctoral
and
dissertation.
And he had this funny accent, I remember, you know, Skrepnik, and he was like a Ukrainian Gamulka, you know. That's how he described him.
Wonderful. That was interesting. Unfortunately, I saw him personally when I was back at times as a student, so I could not experience him and like a personal contact, but working on Ukrainian translation of this book, and I think I'm glad that the International Renaissance Foundation supported the translation publication of this book, so it is published in Ukrainian. And for me, it was really, even though I studied history and all about Ukrainization and but I was really surprised how much it was not only about the spelling in Ukraine, you know, the huge discussion still in orthography of Ukrainian writing.
Yeah, pravopis. And
exactly.
Yes, the letter G and the letter H as
and
well.
Cathedra, katedra, and many other things, but also about economic theories.
Yeah.
Volobuyevshina,
exactly. National deviationist, yes.
And how many of them were there? And I'm unfortunately, many, even young Ukrainians, are really not aware of those developments. As I said, because historically speaking, this 100 years of this legacy is not something people had an opportunity to study in schools, discuss on broader scale. And
well, you see, Maxim, I think a lot of people, the majority, are not aware of what happened in the 20s and what were branded as national deviations, whether in the arts or in literature with Khvilyovy or whatever it was, economics, Volobuyev, etc. But look at the 60s, more recently. People aren't aware that, you know, some of the Shestisyatniki, the people writing in Ukrainian on existential themes, were branded as deviationists, let's say, as people who refused to toe the party line. Not because they were nationalists, but because they wanted to be free creative souls, but to express themselves in Ukrainian. And the apogee of all of that, or the nadir, was the ousting of the First Party Secretary Shelis in 72 on a charge of national deviationism. It's as if history repeated itself. And somehow, though this is so recent, it's not in the present consciousness of the Ukrainian people, the population, even the younger people. Maybe at school they're getting some of this impact. You know, it's as if somehow, well, independence fell to us from on earth because the Soviet Union collapsed, and we've been somehow zigzagging along. Yes, we are Ukraine, we're different, but the price of that independence, the investment, ideological in terms of lives, in terms of struggle, etc., it doesn't seem to be really to have registered.
Mm. For a number of reasons, and I would mention, because since you mentioned the term national deviation and nationalism, I think there is a huge misunderstanding about this term from political theory perspective and science, and this is also true for the Russian legacy, because the problem with the whole Russian Empire, it really did not experience a period of national liberation in that respect, because it had narodnictvo as such, and that was a really bad translation of the Polish version of nationality. It was translated as narodowość, and then the Russian with Uvarov theories and stuff like that. When I teach my students, and I do agree there are like Michael Frieden, who is one of the well-known scholar on political ideologies. In his book, he does not recognize nationalism as a separate ideology. But I always say to my students that we can regard nationalism as the only victorious ideology. And what I mean by that is, on the level of language, something that is difficult to register with the Ukrainian language is, for example, we also have the word nazia, nation, but we use it differently because the wealth of nations, for example, exactly, it's difficult to translate because we're talking about the state, and this is država as such is another term, but then organization, United Nations organization. We say Organizacija Objedinjenih Nacij. It is even difficult for Ukrainians to imagine Organizacija Objedinjenih Držav, United States, something differently. And now we have visa-free travel to the European Union countries, most of them at least. But then previously, everybody experienced this problem when filling out any application form for any visa, that nationality means citizenship.
But do you think, Maxim, sorry to interrupt you, maybe part of our problem is that we've always confused these incomplete processes of nation state or nation building and at the same time state building, creating out of an ethnographic mass a modern political nation, and at the same time building a viable modern state. The two processes have been parallel. Sometimes they've overlapped, but they seem to be incomplete even now, 100 years later.
Exactly. So I'm glad you underlined this aspect, because for many in Ukraine, especially those who believe, who share, I would say, this Russian vision of Ukraine as being not a failed state, I would say, but this is just a part of Russia, a version of Russia, because even back in the Russian imperial times, I read a small piece from an article which says that, and those who claim to be Ukrainian nationalists, this is all the Austrian-Hungarian's influence, all this
ideas. Invention of an Austrian coffee shop.
Exactly.
Yes, I think Rosa Luxemburg even said that.
Yeah. Oh, I loved mentioning this book by Mace about the Rosa Luxemburg ideas about the national question or issue as such is also interesting. But yes, I would agree. And then the problem with many Ukrainians is that the modern countries, the most successful countries, they had their own stage of nationalism, a very high peak nationalism. But that really came along with developing and improving the state system. And when we move from conception of nation like imagined community, where we all share a same heritage, understanding and political nation, not only blood and soil, as we would have in other nationality theories. And as I said, many Ukrainians who would say and support a lot, like Russian language in Ukraine, who would, and this is a huge problem, even claim that the Russian speaker population needs to have its rights protection, stuff like that, they really have this misunderstanding that we are now having both processes together. We need, you know, in Germany they have this very nice term Nachholungsbedarf, where there is a need to catch up with the developed nations, and we're going through this process. And that's why understanding that we have 100 years of our first statehood legacy, and we're now the development, and language is important, understanding Soviet history is also important, and what we claim to be national divi. Many of those writers and people said they're not nationalists in that respect, but having right to express yourself on different issues in your language and have the scene and potential readership and people who would read your stuff, and I mean writings, and people who would be able to publish it and discuss it, there's a huge progress in Ukrainian. I remember times when going to movies and having a movie dubbed into Ukrainian was something funny.
Yes.
Especially when it's like action movie from Hollywood. Now it's norm. But I can recall those times where with you...
Which is very important. And also look at the flourishing since the revolution of dignity of publishing in Ukrainian. Many of the best international literary works are appearing in Ukrainian first.
And Ukrainian translations. I'm active.
That's
now.
What I mean. Yeah.
Now, I recently submitted my Ukrainian translation of Fromm's Escape from Freedom. There were two Russian translations already, but I was commissioned to translate this book. I'm glad this is very important. The Creative Class by Richard Florida, also my translation. This Glushko version of the book, version of the book, four of my translations have been published and presented. So I'm glad there is readership and people who buy books and who support this and flourishing. Published in Ukrainian, translation on foreign literature in Ukrainian. This is really improving and changing the language as well.
Of course. Maxim, okay. So we're speaking, about these qualitative improvements and connected with modernization and the building of a modern Ukrainian political nation. Okay, let's spend the last while, because we don't want to come across as being too theoretical and too philosophical. Let's look at the nitty-gritty. Parliament has just opened its sessions. There are the opening broadsides in preparation for the presidential election campaign. What are the key issues of the day that you see as a young political scientist? What should we be watching in the coming months?
You know, I'm 35, and the thing about myself which I think needs improvement is discipline. And our Verkhovna Rada Parliament also needs some discipline in terms of being able to get together and really pass laws, or at least have decent hearings. And when they started, I followed today actively before noon over was happening. So discipline is the huge problem. Since this this session changes to the electoral law.
But is discipline not simply a reflection, not simply of laziness or self-interest, but of political will? If the political paymasters, oligarchs and others, and political paymasters literally, don't crack the whip and don't have whips, as in the British system, forcing their deputies to attend, then what can we expect? I mean, they're used to just coming and going as they see fit.
I also was wondering, just this idea came to my mind, maybe we should reduce the room, as in the classical British Parliament, so that not all deputies would physically fit into the room. Maybe that would help. Yes, political will, unfortunately, is also a term a lot with a huge misuse in Ukrainian politics. When people don't know what is happening and political scientists are lazy to get into, as you say, nitty-gritty, they say this is a problem with political will. But I do agree with you that the most disciplined faction is Leshko's faction. The
radicals.
Radicals. They all attend, they go, and hopefully they all get well paid. Otherwise, maybe I'm making a joke. I wouldn't like to offend them or something, but we see that some are more disciplined, and then using the whip. But then democracy is something, and this is from Escape from Freedom, where this will to be self-disciplined can come from within, especially feeling responsibility. And with the problem with the Orange Revolution, people, the population had huge hopes for positive developments. But again, not going to philosophically, the first issue is the discipline with Verkhovna Rada, because many laws await them. For example, the changes to the electoral law. We need to do something that would be a slap in the face if we elect our deputies and president using the laws of the Yanukovych regime. That would be a huge surprise. Then the CVK,
the Central Electoral Commission.
Thank you. We need to change the constellation and the huge political play between the president.
We need to open up the system, in other words.
Yes, exactly.
In shortcut, because it's still a closed system. It's still masquerading as a fully democratic one. But you and I and the population know that the reality is different. And we are committed to Europe. We are committed to a democratic future. And yet we are still retaining these residual elements from systems that we claim that we have overthrown or discarded.
My PhD dissertation I defended in 2010 was institutional isomorphism, where we change the structures by their appearances, facade democracy, and not by their content. So this is one of the phenomena, because I would say that there are certain fields where there is lack of political will to change some institutions, because some actors, those who have the whip and the money, are afraid that the system might collapse.
But do you think, okay, because time is running short, do you think that we're at the stage yet where new forces can, I wouldn't say emerge, because they're probably around, but be allowed to make themselves felt sufficiently? Or is the system open enough? Or is it still, shall we say, the status quo demands, because of the oligarchical setup, that only, shall we say, trusted or those elements that serve the status quo, the present setup, will be allowed through?
Their brief mention, a friend of ours, Mikhailo Vinitsky, we had one discussion about how I understand oligarchs. Who are the oligarchs? Imagine you or I were successful businessmen in Ukraine. The only way for us to protect our business from any misdeeds by law enforcement, by the state, by different structures, by taxation office, blah, 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 is to have our representative in Verkhovna Rada. Unfortunately, this is so. This system is changing step by step, because with huge Soviet legacy as post-Soviet bureaucracy, the only way for you and me, if we were businessmen, were to have like somebody in Verkhovna Rada or political force or something. That is why
it's normal. It happens in Congress and in the Senate,
exactly,
and in the British Parliament.
The problem is degree of protection. And why? So the problem is how much you need somebody protecting your interest, and how much your interests are endangered. Because nobody in nobody in the United States or the United Kingdom would expect such raids by different competing oligarchs and such interests of different actors who are really not within the business sphere to take over your business, basically take it away from you. This is unfortunately still possible in Ukraine. So in order for those political forces that have already emerged and are around, as you say, in order for them to get into the parliament or local councils and stuff, we really need to improve the state capacities.
State capacities and discipline within that, playing by the rules.
Exactly.
But on the other hand, the other side of the coin is that these oligarchs, the main ones, they have an obscene amount of control,
true,
financial and political. Yes, it's fair that they be represented. Business interests should be represented, as in all functioning democracies, but they shouldn't be the body, the dog wagging the tail society. It should be the other way around. And my question to you is really, do you see signs that the system is gradually breaking up, or can we expect more of the same for the next 4 or 5 years? Given the candidates we have available, given the resources that are available, given access to the media, etc. Yes, civil society has its representatives who would like that change, but do they really stand a chance still?
They do have a chance. Since I'm teaching a lot of statistics, for example, I always say that normal standard distribution curve never touches the axis, and that is to allow even the most improbable to happen. So everything is probable, but possible, but the question is in terms of probabilities. I would say that so far the best Ukraine development is that we're now opening up the system. And they do have, I always finish my interviews on a positive note, that Ukraine moves like, you know, three steps forward, 2 steps back, but still we have this one step of progress. And I hope there are so many good initiatives of Ukrainian NGOs to bring these ideas to the population, how to vote, whom to support, how to control the government. There is a positive development, and I'm really looking forward to this opening up the system and potentialities of many new Ukrainian political forces within this country to be able to break this oligarchic domination, as we say, and to move this country to a better future, hopefully.
Okay, fine. Finally, last question. Your comments as an observer, as a teacher, as a theorist, but also as somebody who's studied this issue for a long time. The level of political culture, are we there yet? Okay, you're teaching at an elite school. Do you find, from your contacts with other universities around the country, do we have a sufficient number of young people interested in politics and raising standards, raising the level of awareness, political culture, and setting an example for others?
It is a very clever move to ask me the most complicated question at the end. So thank you for that. Well, really, we can really not compare Kyiv Mohyla Academy to 99% of other Ukrainian universities. Our rival university now is the Ukrainian Catholic University in Lviv by many standards, and Kyiv National University Taras Shevchenko is different. But I would say, yes, there is interest of a younger generation in politics and School for Policy Analysis, which I'm now director of. We are having a project to research, we started this summer, to research these informal educational activities like School of Political Perspective or something, who are offering short-time courses, mostly informally, for the interested public, those who would like to become assistants to deputy MPs or maybe on the local councils. There's huge interest in those. So our research hypothesis, rather research question is, do they really have the content, or are they mostly reaction to this hype of supply demand question? When people are interested, they hesitate to go to a classical university, but they would like to be active in the politics and policies, and to substitute they would pay for 2 weeks something a course. So,
well, sorry, one last question as a PS, I suppose, as a footnote, but important for younger people that you are teaching: is politics a dirty word? Is it linked with opportunity? Is it linked with public service and duty? Where is the balance in those notions? Maybe there are other factors. What brings people into it to study politics, given the present setup? Is it because there is an optimism that things will eventually change and that they will have their place there? They may not be active practitioners, but they may be able to influence others.
You again ask me a question. I'm trying to be very short. First, unlike Russia, with one of the most popular subjects, fields where people go to study with the highest competition rate in Russia is to study state bureaucracy, what we call public administration. That is called differently Russia, but by the number of people who apply, who would like to study, I was really surprised. I took it for my course on post-Soviet legacy in Ukrainian politics at the Helsinki University this year. This is different to Ukraine. Ukrainian younger generation are not dreaming of becoming bureaucrats, because unlike in Russia, being a bureaucrat does not secure you with a good income and many dachas and villas and stuff. One. Secondly, in popular culture, and this is not only in Ukraine, this is throughout the whole world, the interest in politics and different idea about politics is already there. House of Cards, Game of Thrones, things where, like Black Sails even, something about the popular culture.
Even Revolution of Dignity and Maidans. Mm.
Yeah, exactly this. So in Ukraine, both they have a good collision. This world tendency to think politics and who is a politician, naming House of Cards or Game of Thrones with history, but with a lot of politics. I supervised a bachelor thesis on developing the idea of politician in the series and things like that and TV shows. This is one. Secondly, Ukrainians with all the revolutions of dignity, finally there is this feeling that some things are built not only by revolutions and fightings, but built by decent step-by-step work when you need to concentrate, take action, and this is something that cannot be done by a single revolution. It needs a lot of effort.
Finally, I always ask my, not a difficult question, I always ask my guest last-minute thoughts. What would you wish the listeners? They can be your students, they can be the public at large. One last thought, inspirational, hopefully.
I always wish people to think about their thinking, because the only way to improve the world is to start with yourself. So starting improving yourself, your way of thinking, reflection, meditation and stuff. So please help the world by improving yourselves.
So it used to be doctor, heal thyself. Now it's human being, heal thyself, work with yourself.
Exactly.
Okay, you've been listening to a very inspiring discussion with Maxim Yakovlev, who represents the new generation of Ukrainian political scientists and scholars. He's director of the School of Policy Analysis at the National University of Kyiv Mohyla Academy, associate professor, Department of Politics, and as we've heard, he's translated some of the seminal works into Ukrainian from other languages. Thank you very much, Maxim.
Thank you.
And now on to music. Here's a track from a debut album by the Kuka Band called No, Mene Nema. No, I'm not there, or I'm not here. Enjoy.
Мене забудуть твоїм сміхом середину душі мою руйнують. Славні дивиться око, немов потроху. Триває, залишаючи тепло зі свого боку. А хто не бачив світла, відкриєм хмари, співаючи в обнімку з Бобом.
We jam, you jam me.
Щира брехня в обличчя, тобі не личить. Кожен день руйнуємось, снимо це звичай. І замість суті є лиш пусті слова. Кричимо один до одного.
Но мене нема!
Якщо ти хочеш миру, готуйся до війни. І чуй це світло, що я усередині. Кажи слова поволі, немов малій дитині. Кричали добрі люди, що мама мила раму. Твої діла шанують, як на обличчі шрами. Відкриті усі двері, та йдемо через стіну. Брехні і так багато, застрягли по коліна. Коли тебе спитають, які далі слова, кричи усім у відповідь.
Но мене нема!
Оно скользкое, как струд,
и голодное, как зверь,
и как пропасть. Из свободного падения невозможно убежать.
И за ручкой нету двери.
Скользи, скользи, если быстрота и лед, глубина меня пугает.
Огонь меня влечет.
Совершенно. Очевидно, что вопросы задаются только тем, кто за кадрами или боссы.
Но мы на
нема. Но мы на нема. Секунда, минута, минутами часы. Выбирай, спасишь дважды,
что поставить на весы.
Девушка, а на деле нету дел. Все, что дальше циферблатов, там коллапс и беспредел.
Может, хватит
убираться об асфальт, отвечать на все вопросы.
Ты реально всех достал,
отрывая словно спутник от земли. Без орбиты, без одежды, без осмы.
And looking forward. Well, there you have it for this week. Tune in next week for another edition of Ukraine Calling, in which I'll be talking to a representative of one of Ukraine's most distinguished families, and now the mayor of Luhyu, Michel Terestenko. What has he encountered in moving back to Ukraine from France? Well, he'll tell us. We'd love to have your feedback, so write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. This is Bohdan Nahailo for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. Thanks so much for listening.